overall, it seems like eating less protein is a conserved, metabolically good thing for many people who are not exercising as well as rodents.
Welcome to Longevity by Design, a podcast designed to give individuals access to the leading scientific information in the field of longevity. The ability to add years to your life and life to your years needs no opinion. Join us as we ask science to take the wheel. In each episode, Dr. Gil Blander joins a co-host and an industry expert in the field of longevity, shining a light and getting the answers to the key question, how can we live a longer, healthier life?
Hello, I'm Ashley Reaver, and I'm joined by Dr. Gil Blander. Welcome to Longevity by Design, How to Live a Longer, Healthier Life. We're produced by Inside Tracker, your science-based guide to optimizing your body from the inside out. Our guest today is Dr. Dudley Lamming. Dr. Lamming is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism. He received his PhD in experimental pathology from Harvard University and pursued postdoc research at the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research. Dr. Lamming is also the principal investigator, the Lamming Laboratory for the Molecular Physiology of Aging, where his research focuses on harnessing nutrient-responsive signaling pathways to promote health and longevity. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you, Ashley.
So, Dudley, we met long ago in Boston when I've been a postdoctoral fellow at Lenny's lab, and you have been a graduate student at David Sinclair lab. Very exciting time, and it's a pleasure having you. But we would like actually to go further away in your life and start by what inspired you to become a scientist?
I think originally I was thinking about being a doctor, and that was sort of one of my sort of goals growing up. But I think I became, more interested in the research side of things. And so through a series of happenstance, I wound up working at a biotech company after college for a couple years, and then moved on to graduate school.
Excellent. And why have you decided to work on aging?
Well, I thought, some of the work that Dr. Garrente was doing right around the time I was thinking about what to do with my life, it sounded really interesting. And I thought that research in aging would be a good thing to work on. And then at the end of graduate school, I sort of reconsidered and was thinking about what it is that I'd want to, do for sort of the rest of my life in terms of research, right? And, when I was thinking about it, I thought that, aging research was one of the main things that was really exciting to me. And so I decided that, I wanted to stay in the aging field and proceeded from there when I was sort of thinking about where to do a postdoc.
Excellent. So talking about that, caloric restriction is a very hot term and everyone is talking about it. And I know that you also done some or still doing some research in this domain. And there are some question about whether cutting the calories is enough, or do you need also to have some fasting period in order to be sure that it will affect your longevity? So what is your opinion about that?
Yeah, so we published a paper last year that was led by a graduate student in my lab, Heidi Pack, who's now a PhD postdoc researcher in Joseph Takahashi's lab at UT Southwestern. And so, one of the things that she was really interested in was the feeding rhythm question. And so, what we looked at was whether fasting was really important in the response to calorie restriction or not. And so when we do calorie restriction in an animal, overall, this has been done for about a century now. And throughout that entire period of time, when rats or mice are fed on calorie restricted diets, they are almost always fed once per day. And that's pretty much just the way that people did this because of their convenience, right? It's easier to have someone go to the mouse cage and put food in once a day than have them put in three meals a day. And what we found was that they either food in about 2 hours. And this is something that calorie restriction researchers have noticed, for years, probably decades, but no one's really focused in on what the consequence of that might be. And so what Heidi did was design a series of diet regimens where we could piece out the contributions of fasting to the effects of a CR diet. So she had some mice that were fed ad libitum. They had free access to food. So, you know, they ate whenever they wanted to. She had our sort of traditional calorie-restricted mice. She had mice that were on a calorie-restricted diet, but it was actually a low-energy diet. And so they could eat as much as they wanted of this food, but even though they had essentially free access to the food, the number of calories that they are eating was restricted. And interestingly, what we found was that this diluted diet, where calories alone are being restricted, seemed to not have many of the metabolic benefits of calorie restriction. So normally calorie restriction with fasting gives you improved insulin sensitivity. Without fasting, it doesn't. It gives you improved resilience and less frailty as you age. Without fasting, it doesn't do that. It has some effects, beneficial effects on memory. Without fasting, it doesn't do that. And calorie restriction with fasting extends lifespan, but without fasting, it actually made mice live shorter. And so that fasting period seems to be very essential for the mice. And conversely, in another set of experiments, Heidi showed that if you train mice to eat all of their food in about 2 to 3 hours and then take their food away, those animals are not calorie restricted. They're eating a normal number of calories, but molecularly and metabolically, they look the same as CR animals. So at the gene transcription level, about 90 or 95% of the genes are pretty much the same between fasted animals and calorie restricted animals. And so fasting alone seems to have a lot of beneficial effects. Rafa DeCabo's lab published a paper a number of years ago where mice were sort of unintentionally fasted for about 12 hours a day. So really not that long in the grand scheme of things. But those mice were able to live about 10% longer, probably as a result of this fasting. And so it seems like fasting is beneficial for health and longevity and is very geroprotective. And that, you know, if you think about if these lessons apply to humans, and of course that remains to be seen, it would seem like calorie restriction should definitely include some sort of fasting component.
Excellent. That's very interesting and I think novel, because before that we saw that just cutting the calories can be enough. So it's a very good lesson.
Thank you. And I think there's been a couple of clinical trials of time-restricted feeding in humans now as well. And while there have been some beneficial effects when calories are compressed to a very short period of day, humans don't overeat to the same extent. So you know, it seems like limiting, at least so far, it seems like limiting your calorie consumption to about 8 hours a day is not really sufficient to have a lot of health benefits. Whereas less than that, the 4 hour sort of feeding window, it seems like there are some health benefits, but calories were also reduced. And so we don't really know, you know, if that's separable in humans to the same way that it is in mice, but I think that'll be interesting to find out.
Definitely. And pivoting to something that your lab is really researching a lot now, and I find super interesting, of protein restriction. Over the years, we've seen a lot of different messaging related to the best macronutrient ratios for optimal health. You know, in the 90s, fats were really bad. Carbs being bad seems to recycle every 4 years, if not constantly being there. But protein is one that we often don't hear about, too much protein ever being a bad thing. So can you tell us more about how you practice protein restriction in your lab and some of the findings that you've discovered from your research?
Sure. So protein restriction actually has a really long history. It's almost as long as calorie restriction. And even in the laboratory, there's been a lot of questions about whether protein restriction is good or bad. And what we believe that is for a couple reasons. Sort of historically, maybe sometimes people have restricted rodents or other organisms the protein too much, because protein, you know, is completely essential to life. And they're non-essential amino acids. You know, you absolutely have to have them in your diet for health. Also protein quality, sort of what the amino acid composition of the protein might be. And so we really got into this due to some really cool work by Steve Simpson and David LeCouter's laboratory that was published in 2014, where they looked at different macronutrient ratios and how they affected the health of mice. And so they actually looked at 25 different diets. what was really interesting was the ones that were on a low protein diet seemed to live the longest. And so we started looking into this, and there, you know, certainly many, many studies, right, that suggest that dietary protein is good for you. But when you think about what the context that is, the context is usually in the context of people who are exercising or building skeletal muscle, really trying to bulk up. Whereas, and, you know, that might certainly apply to athletes. But, you know, when we look at, say, the American population, you know, 70% of the country is overweight or obese, right? And so the sort of sedentary mice that we're looking at is probably most relevant to those people who are obese and overweight, and maybe less relevant to the people who are exercising and are thin and, you know, trying to build muscle for health. So that's sort of the first thing to say. So if you look, although, in these epidemiological studies, and nutritional epidemiology has, you know, a lot of caveats, but you know, one advantage is that you can look at a lot of people. You can look at 40,000 people, even more, over very long periods of time. And if you do that, various groups have done this, at doing both retrospective studies and prospective studies. And what they found is that lower protein diets tend to be associated with less cancer, with less cardiovascular disease, and in all of the studies, very clearly, less diabetes. And so, you know, the diabetes link is by far the strongest because it's been shown in many different studies. And so a number of years ago, we collaborated with Luigi Fontana's laboratory to look at metabolic outcomes in a human protein restriction trial that he was running. This was very short, about 6 weeks long. It was in obese, overweight males who had prostate cancer. And we protein restricted those people by about half. So they went from 17% of their calories coming from protein, pretty standard, to about 7 to 9% of their calories coming from protein. And the thing that was really dramatic was there was pretty dramatic weight loss. And so they lost about 1.5 pounds per week. And the majority of that was fat mass. And their fasting blood glucose levels went down as well. Since dietary protein, as I think you're well aware, you know, promotes satiety, it helps make you feel full, these people actually had about 10% increase in their calorie intake. And so they're eating more and they gain less weight. And then over the next several years in a series of experiments that we and other groups have published, we showed that you can reproduce this in rodents. So mice and rats that eat low protein diets tend to gain less weight. They tend to be leaner as a result of the target's fat mass more than lean mass. They have improved glucose tolerance, sometimes improved insulin sensitivity as well. And overall, they seem to live longer. We reproduced this in our own lab. If we put mice on a low protein diet, they can live as long as 30% longer. In our hands, that seems to be male specific. So we don't see a lifespan effect in females. But the metabolic benefits seem to occur in both sexes. So overall, it seems like eating less protein is a conserved, metabolically good thing for many people who are human, who are not exercising, as well as rodents.
And why do you think that it's a male-specific? What is the explanation of male-specific? Why it's only male and not females?
Well, I think one important thing to note is that when we look at studies in mice, right, most studies use BLAC6 mice that are essentially a genetically inbred strain. So every animal is identical to every other animal. And one problem with that is that the human population is very genetically heterogeneous, right, containing not only both sexes, but millions of individuals with different genomes. And so when we started to look at different strains and sexes using a whole panel of recombinant inbred strains now, as well as some other inbred strains, what we found is that the metabolic responses definitely vary by strain. And one thing that could be, it's that it could be that in other strains and sexes that females might benefit more than males. So, you know, it's possible that this is limited to BLAC6. Driving into the transcriptome, though, so we looked at the muscle transcriptome because we were really interested in the fact that the males had less frailty as they age, which again is sort of counterintuitive because you think branched amino acids are essential for building muscle, that maybe the animals would be more frail when they got old. Well, as long as they start when they're young, that's not the case. If they start when they're young, they actually are fitter by the time that they're very old. Looking at the transcription, the gene transcription in these tissues, we found that male and females had totally different transcriptional responses to branch amino acid restriction. And interestingly, in the males, one of the pathways that came up was the mTOR signaling pathway, mTOR being this very important protein kinase that I think many of your listeners are probably familiar with. And it seems to play a key role in aging. And actually, we saw an upregulation of certain pathways, but what we actually saw upregulated were inhibitors of the mTOR pathway. And so when we looked at the phosphorylation of mTOR substrates in those tissues, we saw that in males, but not in the females, there was decreased mTOR kinase activity. And so at least it correlates with lower mTOR signaling, and dietary protein and amino acids and things like leucine are very well known to be strong mTOR agonists. So at least there's a correlation with mTOR activity. There might be other pathways that are also mediating this that remains to be seen.
I think that's an important point for most people, of just being realistic with how much they're exercising as well. I know there's info about 40% of Americans don't do any physical activity. So the protein recommendations that we often hear really probably don't apply to 40%, at least 40% of the population. All these benefits that you described, are they independent of calorie restriction? Or is it coupled with protein restriction and calorie restriction?
So these are independent of calorie restriction. The one thing that seems to be true across the board is that if you cut protein intake, the animals eat more calories. They're basically trying to compensate for the fact that there's less protein. So most of our studies, we cut protein by 2/3, by 67%. And then with compensatory eating, the actual protein restriction turns out to be around 50%. Because they're eating more calories. You can calculate that a couple different ways, though, because they're leaner and they weigh less overall. So it's not easy to sort of normalize for body weight exactly. But definitely, you know, it's very clear, right? There's an absolutely essential need for protein in some amount. You know, you need those essential amino acids in order to live and build protein and so on. But it definitely seems like you're right, that, right, particularly for people who are sedentary, probably the protein recommendations might very well be too high. And one thing that we're really trying to think about is how to, you know, take what we're doing, and particularly in terms of looking at genetic loci and genetic variants that might regulate the response to dietary protein and individual amino acids, and figure out, you know, is there a way to look at your genome and figure out, you know, what would be the best diet for you? And so I'll tell you, looking across strains and sexes, a lot of strains benefit from protein restriction, but some don't. There are even some strains where, you know, we restrict protein and they gain more fat mass. And so, you know, different people, of course, have different responses to diets in the real world. And so maybe your genes help determine whether you would do best on a low protein diet, as our studies would suggest, or maybe there are people who are going to do best on a keto diet or a Mediterranean diet or something like that. And then exercise on top of this might, you know, be another factor.
That's super interesting. And you know, you said that in your subjects, all the genetics are pretty much exactly the same. Where do you feel like the research is with being able to take those results that you found and generalize them to humans, not just for protein restriction, but all the other diets that you just mentioned? Where do you feel like science stands there right now?
I mean, I think that people are starting to realize this, and, you know, it's very clear that different strains do have different responses. And so in our published work, we've only looked at Black 6, but we're now looking at protein restriction in about 40 different strains. And so, you know, we see this very wide variation between strains in the response to dietary protein, whether or not, you know, they get leaner or more fat, whether they have improved glucose tolerance or not. And then sex is another factor too. Sex doesn't always go with genotype in terms of the overall effect. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of interest, generally speaking, in personalized medicine. And I think, you know, personalized, or as Pankaj Gafai's lab published a review recently calling it precision geronutroscience, you know, figuring out, you know, what the best diet for each individual to promote healthy aging would be. I think that's what we're moving towards.
Really interesting. And you mentioned branch chain amino acids in particular having an influence on that mTOR pathway. For just a little bit of background, would you mind explaining a bit more about those branched chain amino acids and perhaps how they differ from especially the other essential amino acids?
Sure. So mice and humans both have 9 essential amino acids in their diet. And 3 of those are the so-called branched chain amino acids based on their chemical structure, which are leucine, isoleucine, and valine. And I think many people in the general populace tend to be aware of branched chain amino acids just because it's promoted very heavily as supplements for people who are working out or weightlifting and so on. And so these have been known to be sort of metabolically special for a long time. So it was in the late 1960s, it was shown that these are elevated in the blood of people who are obese. And about 10 to 15 years ago, a lot of people started digging into this again. And they found that not only was it elevated in human obesity, but it's also elevated in multiple mice and rat models of obesity. It's also elevated in the blood of people with type 2 diabetes. It correlates very well with your blood sugar. So it correlates well with hemoglobin, glycated hemoglobin levels. And it's even a predictor of your progression of type 2 diabetes. So if you have high levels of branched chain amino acids in your blood, you're more likely to develop type 2 diabetes. And lots of diet interventions that cause weight loss modulate branched chain amino acids as well. And so calorie restriction is one of them, but gastric bypass surgery also lowers branched chain amino acids. And what we found in our studies was that in our protein-restricted humans that we looked at with Dr. Fontana, we found that branched chain amino acid levels were lowered during a protein-restricted diet too. And the thing that was really interesting is we looked at all the amino acids in the blood, and the ones that went down were the branched chain amino acids, right? We're also lowering the levels of methionine, which is supposed to be low in a vegan diet, and everything else. But the ones that went down were the branched chain amino acids. And so that was one of the main reasons we focused on that. We also were really interested in the time in mTOR signaling, and leucine is the best mTOR agonist of all the amino acids. Turns out that, probably speaking, that's sort of a red herring from the perspective of metabolic health at least. So in our most recent work, we've looked at the effects of the individual 3 branched chain amino acids. And in our mice, we restricted each one of them individually by about 67%. The really nice thing about doing nutrition studies in mice as opposed to humans is that, you know, mice eat exactly what you tell them to. They're not sneaking any food. We can record exactly, what they're eating and monitor them. We know how much exercise they're getting. So, we can control things very, very well, much better than we can with the human study. And so when we restrict leucine in those mice, almost nothing happens, which was really surprising. And in fact, you can even take it all the way down to 0 for brief periods of time. And even if you do that, very little happens metabolically to animals. Longer term, of course, they would get ill. If you restrict isoleucine, though, which is actually by far one of the smallest amino acids in terms of abundance, we found really dramatic effects. So restricting isoleucine by 67% improved glucose tolerance dramatically, completely blocked the effects of sort of normal growth on fat mass accretion. So the animals didn't gain fat mass as they got older. Overall, very, very potent at inducing all sorts of interesting hormones that are associated with weight loss and energy expenditure. It causes what's called browning or beiging of white adipose tissue, switches the white adipose tissue from a storage depot to one where it's a tissue that sort of burns fat and sort of creates additional energy. Interestingly, in the case of diet-induced obesity, if you take a mouse and you make it fat, and then you specifically just restrict the level of isoleucine, the mice loses essentially all of its excess adipose mass in about 3 weeks. And this is true even though calorie restriction is not affected. In fact, if you do it for longer, calorie intake goes up, even though the mice stay lean. And it stays lean and glucose tolerant, insulin sensitive, even though they're eating a diet that's, terrible for them. So it's a sort of a Western diet that's high in fat, high in sucrose, and really energy dense. So isoleucine is really potent. One of the things that we found was we worked with some epidemiologists here to look at nutrition information from people who live in Wisconsin, where we also have all sorts of other data as well. And we found that BMI, body mass index, essentially how heavy one is, you know, is actually correlated with how much isoleucine is in your diet. And so, you know, there definitely seems to be an interesting link there. And this link wasn't found for the other branched amino acids either. It also correlates pretty well with another study back from 2019 by a German group that found that the more isoleucine is in your blood, the higher your risk of overall mortality.
So Dudley, how do you explain the effect of isoleucine? Why isoleucine and not leucine? As you said, leucine is supposed to be mTOR activator. So what isoleucine is doing that make all of those benefits?
That's an excellent question. And we're approaching that a couple of ways. But I'll tell you that from a metabolic standpoint, in any event, we think the effects on the liver and hepatic insulin sensitivity, which seem to be very dramatic, appear not to be mTOR mediated. And so we think that another pathway is probably being activated. One of the things that's interesting about isoleucine rather than leucine or valine is how it's catabolized. And so when these branched amino acids are broken down into essentially energy units, leucine goes entirely to acetyl-CoA and fats, while valine goes entirely to propionate, which can be turned into glucose and other TCA cycle intermediates. Isoleucine is sort of unique in that it actually splits in half, and half goes to each pathway. And so from a sensing standpoint, it might make sense that isoleucine sensing would be preferential in terms of being able to balance out those sort of fat and sugar pathways. But that's sort of just a hypothesis at the moment. And we're trying to figure out through a variety of techniques, you know, what it is that isoleucine is actually doing. Of course, you know, isoleucine, as it happens, tends to be low in certain foods. And, you know, we can talk about that. But I think from a practical standpoint, it would probably be easiest, right, to eventually be able to identify ways, be pharmaceutical or otherwise, that we could, you know, engage these same mechanisms, whatever they are.
It's really cool. How do you approach, all I keep thinking about is, like, do you get frustrated when you see people pushing BCAA supplements or, you know, recommending super high meat diets? It sounds like, you know, meat being where you can get most of these 9 essential amino acids from animal products. Certainly there's some plants that provide all 9 as well. But we always hear about all of these benefits of consuming less meat that, you know, don't necessarily tie to less saturated fat in the diet. It's interesting to hear all of these other metabolites that can have really big influences on our overall health that we haven't necessarily identified or at least brought to mainstream consumption of protein.
I mean, I don't get frustrated, and, you know, everybody has their bad habits, dietary and otherwise, right? That, you know, there's always room for everyone to improve. So, you know, it doesn't really feel frustrating to me. I will say that, you know, from the food standpoint, we've sort of looked through the USDA food database, and, you know, if you're going to eat meat, then you'd probably be best to focus on emu and turkey, according to our findings, which actually goes very well with what you'll find on bodybuilder websites, because they're like, stay away from turkey, it's a waste. So it tends to be lower overall in the BCAAs relative to other proteins. Plants actually seem to vary quite dramatically in a variety of ways. And there's some things that are sort of counterintuitive as well. So fish seems to be high in branched amino acids, but of course fish has a variety of health benefits as well.
Interesting. And is there an optimal kind of macronutrient breakdown? We've talked about, of course, all sorts of precision nutrition recommendations that we could give, but do you feel like there's an optimal breakdown? And do you think there'd be big differences between what you find in mice versus what would apply to humans?
It's an interesting question, right? You know, we've definitely been really interested in this idea of, you know, could you design the ideal diet or at least the ideal protein source? And there's a lot of factors in that. I think mice would be easier to do some of the initial designing in for sure. But of course, we'd want to make sure that this is relevant to humans. And I think, you know, our epidemiological data so far on the individual amino acids with isoleucine, as well as some other things that are in the works, definitely seems to suggest that there is a good correlation between the micronutrients that are good for humans and good for mice. But, you know, it wouldn't be shocking if there are differences too, because of course mice are not just small furry humans.
So Dudley, I would like to go with your permission back to the molecular explanation. And I know that in at least in one of your papers, you mentioned FGF21 as a modulator for isoleucine. So can you explain what is the pathway and what is the effect of FGF21?
Sure. FGF21 is a hormone that's found in both mice and humans. And it seems to be released from multiple tissues, primarily the liver, but also fat and muscle, in response to what we probably call nutrient stress, or maybe environmental stress. So some things that induce FGF21 in mice include protein restriction, methionine restriction, sort of a vegan-ish diet, if you will. Cold exposure. So, in response to cold, FGF21 is released. In humans, we don't have quite as much information. It's probably linked to cold exposure as well. In humans, there's also a link to, exercise. So it can be released in response to exercise as well as, cold exposure. And it does a lot of things. But the general idea is that it tends to adjust your energy balance. So in a mouse, FGF21 inspires you to eat more food. And so that might be one of the reasons that it's released during protein restriction and, you know, you get more food intake, you're hungrier when you're eating less protein. It also seems to be involved in what we generally call browning or beiging of white adipose tissue or activation of brown adipose tissue. So both mice and humans have white adipose tissue as well as brown adipose tissue. And what FGF21 tends to do is make those tissues produce more energy. Now, why it does this is sort of an interesting question. Now, it makes total sense in cold exposure, right? If you're cold, you want your adipose tissue to burn more fuel so that you stay warm and that you can continue to function even though it's cold outside. Why energy expenditure goes up on a protein-restricted diet or some of these other interventions is a really interesting question that I think we don't have a good answer to yet, but the fact of the matter is that it does. And so we can measure that fuel energy expenditure goes up with FGF21, and that goes up during these various interventions. So FGF21 goes up in when we restrict isoleucine. It goes up in the muscle, in the liver, in the white adipose tissue. It goes up in the blood. And using FGF21 knockout mice that don't have FGF21 in any tissue, we found that the effects of an isoleucine diet on food consumption are entirely dependent on FGF21. So normally a low isoleucine diet causes you to eat a lot more, even though you stay thin. And FGF21 completely blocks that effect on food intake. And on energy expenditure, it blocks about half of the effect on energy intake. So FGF21 definitely plays a role. Now, one thing I should say, though, is that, you know, FGF21 is a good example, I think, of this issue of sex and genetic background and how they relate to dietary interactions. This is all true in Black 6 males. In Black 6 females, FGF21 has no effect on the effects of isoleucine restriction. We are still working to try and figure out about different strains, but we've published a little bit on what happens to FGF21 in different strains and sexes. And in Black 6 males, you get a very big increase when you restrict protein of FGF21 in the blood. In females, you sort of get a smaller increase. And another common mouse strain called DBA, these mice normally have pretty high levels of FGF21, but dietary protein doesn't do anything to it. And so, you know, trying to figure out how FGF21 relates to these different strains and sexes and how that interacts is something that is going to take a lot of work, I think.
And the effect of FGF21 is specific for isoleucine, or it's also for other branched-chain amino acid?
We did not observe an effect of FGF21 from other amino acids, at least not yet. And branched-chain amino acid restriction itself actually has some very odd effects on FGF21. If you restrict all three, you get some very odd effects. Sometimes it's up, okay. Sometimes it's not. But methionine restriction pretty reliably induces FGF21. Again, there seems to be a sex-specific effect where males have a much bigger induction. Some other groups have shown that threonine in some contexts can also mediate FGF21 levels. So it's not exclusive to branched amino acids, but it's not in every amino acid either.
And just to confirm, it's completely not related to mTOR. That's correct. mTOR is not in the play at all.
I would not bet money on that, because mTOR is sort of a central regulator of metabolism that's linked to a lot of things. There's a paper that shows that if you inject FGF21 into mice in high levels, you inhibit mTOR activity in the liver, and this has some effects. And there are mice that have hyperactive mTOR, and through a variety of pathways, that actually induces FGF21, although it's sort of indirect. So it does not surprise me that there is some interaction between FGF21 and mTOR, and we might find out more about that in the future.
Very interesting.
Yeah. As it relates to people, I know that you said before that insulin-resistant individuals, perhaps individuals that are overweight or obese, would benefit the most, but are there certain populations that you feel like really shouldn't try and experiment with protein restriction? Maybe that's athletes or older individuals?
Well, we don't know what the effects on athletes are just yet. We're actually testing that right now in mice. And so we'll see how that works out. One of the difficulties has sort of been, dealing with the confounding issue of weight. So, if you put a mouse or a human on a treadmill, right, they're going to be thin. And so how does that interact with a diet that's going to keep you thin? And collaborating with another laboratory here, we sort of have established a resistance exercise modality for mice. And so we don't have the same issue, right, because these mice are trying to bulk up, essentially, rather than stay thin. And so we're going to be able to see what dietary protein and branched amino acids do to this in the long term. It's very labor intensive, though, because you need to spend a lot of time training with the mice, being their personal trainer and everything. So it's going to take us a little while to figure that out. But certainly, I would say, what I typically say is, there's lots of data suggesting that more protein for the general population is a bad thing. But also, we have no evidence, as far as I'm aware or that I've ever heard of, the people who are exercising and taking more dietary protein have an increased risk of diabetes, right? So I would say that, most likely, in my opinion, people who are exercising and are taking protein supplements, if that's working out for them and, their doctor doesn't have any concerns or whatever, then it seems pretty safe, I would guess. Whereas maybe those dietary protein shakes for someone who's sedentary and obese, that might not be a good idea. And rationally, you could sort of think about, two ways. And the way I think about it is, if you are exercising and using that protein to build skeletal muscle, right, you're essentially pulling all that protein out of your blood and it's going into your muscle. That muscle is going to be, using glucose. It's going to be making you more insulin sensitive and be healthy. So it makes sense to me that more protein for more muscle would be good. But if you're not using it for muscle building, then that protein has to go somewhere, right? And it's going to be broken down, and it's going to be eventually going to be broken down into something that's associated with glucose or something that's associated with fat. And so even just from an energy standpoint, it would seem to me that that would just be, bad for someone who's not exercising to begin with. I should say, though, that none of our research necessarily applies to people over the age of 65. And so all of the data that suggests that there's effects on mortality is from people under the age of 65. And, in the elderly, there's a big issue with sarcopenia, which is basically, this condition where you have age-associated muscle loss. And it's very well known that people who have sarcopenia have trouble putting on more muscle when they lose muscle. For instance, when they, are immobilized by an injury and they're in bed for a while, they lose muscle mass and they have a very difficult time, if at all possible, to gain that back. And the loss of muscle mass contributes to frailty and loss of quality of life and so on. And so, And our limited amount of work definitely suggests the idea that maybe older mice don't respond as positively to younger mice as protein restriction does. So where that breakpoint is, we don't know. But I think I would say that I'd be very cautious about protein restriction in the elderly. And in fact, you know, many people think that protein supplements might be beneficial for people with sarcopenia. So that remains to be seen. But I think, you know, our results definitely suggest they are definitely concentrated on younger animals and, you know, would most likely be more applicable to younger people.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it's actually a good springboard to my next question. So I think some tracker will have biomarkers. We love to know what is the situation of each person. Then based on that, do you need more of that or less of that? So have you thought about a biomarker for the amount of the protein? Is there something that a user can look at and come and see, hey, I have, now I should restrict my isoleucine or now I shouldn't. Is there something like that or are you thinking about something like that?
Well, you know, biomarkers have always been something that everyone wants, but that have been very difficult to get, right? And, you know, there's a whole list of hormones and metabolites that, you know, people have suggested might be biomarkers for all sorts of things. You know, more recently, there's been the methylation clock, a lot of data suggesting that methylation clocks might be a predictor of biological age as opposed to chronological age. And certainly, you know, people have tried to take sort of machine learning approaches to very large data sets of metabolites or genes and so on. You know, my own personal suspicion is that probably, you know, something along that lines of a machine learning technique in the future is going to be probably the most promising. Because it seems like, you know, overall health, well, you know, humans are pretty good at estimating age, right? So, you know, we can look at a person and we can say, you know, they're old or they're young or not. And for the most part, you know, we're not far off. And if we, you know, see someone who's in really good health but older, we think that they're younger and they probably biologically seem a bit younger, right? And so people have done a lot of stuff looking at machine vision and trying to, you know, look at how wrinkled your skin is and so on to sort of estimate biological age. But I and I don't know if that's going to be, you know, the thing, but it definitely seems to me like, you know, something that integrates everything about you would be sort of the best biomarker rather than a specific chemical. There are certainly ways that one could measure the oxidation rate of various proteins, which is a little bit more intensive than a biomarker. Maybe the methylation clock might be shifted by some of our interventions. That's something we're interested in finding out. And so we don't know what that biomarker is yet, but it'll be interesting to try and determine it.
Okay. And one ignorant logistical question, so I don't spend that much mental energy on that today. How does one resistance train a mouse? how do you do that? What's that protocol look like?
Yeah, this was developed by Dr. Hornberger here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And the mice pull a cart down a track. And so we have a sham cart and then a cart where we load it up with weights. And they can actually, you know, pull more weight the more time that they train. And so they train about 3 times a week. So we'll see how that works out.
Interesting. That's amazing.
And Dudley, what is the, if you look at the body weight of the mice versus what they pull, what is the ratio? Is it like 1-to-1 or is it a...
They pull a lot more than they weigh, which I think is probably true for a lot of humans too, right? Certainly, you know, my kids don't weigh that much. They can pull things that are much heavier than them. And imagine that the same is probably true for adult humans too, in terms of pushing or pulling. Wheels make everything easier. but in the work that we already published with Dr. Hornberger, that was from his lab, it was very clear that, you know, they do sort of bulk up on these, on this intervention. And so we're sort of looking now at how that interacts with dietary protein.
Very cool. And one question that we ask all of our guests towards the end of the podcast is, if there is one decision that you make every day based on nutrition or longevity that you feel comfortable sharing as a tip to our listeners?
Well, that's an interesting one. I guess I would say that the thing I do most is wear a mask so that I avoid COVID, because that's definitely something that increases mortality.
Definitely. Good tip. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today. It was really awesome to learn from you.
Thank you so much for having me. And nice to meet you, Ashley, and good to see you again, Gil.
Thank you so much.
And we look forward to exploring the research in the field of longevity each month with you and the leading scientist. For more information, please go to www.insidetracker.com/podcast.
Thanks for listening to Longevity by Design. Please subscribe to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. Longevity by Design is powered by Inside Tracker, a personalized health optimization platform that helps people improve their lives by improving their bodies from the inside out using personalized, science-backed recommendations for nutrition, supplements, and lifestyle changes. To learn more, visit insidetracker.com/podcasts.